want the truth to be said.
Hello, I'm John Wilson. Thanks for downloading Master Tapes from BBC Radio 4.
I know this much is true. I know this much is true.
Thank you. That was fun.
Hello and welcome to Master Tapes. That's Gary Kemp and Tony Hadley performing the title track of the 1983 Spandau Ballet album True for our audience here at the BBC Maida Vale Studios. In the first part of this programme, Gary and Tony discussed how, after meeting as kids in North London and forming a band, they became leading lights of the early New Romantic movement. But the True album took them to new levels of pop stardom around the world. It included tracks such as Communication, Lifeline and Gold. Now, though, is the turn of our studio audience to ask the questions, not just about True, but about the whole of the Spandau Ballet story, from Blitz Club to Band Split, from Broken Hearts to the Mending of Friendships. Before we get to the questions, though, let me ask you, Gary and Tony, about the people here today, the fans. You know, you were the subject of screaming adulation back in the day.
Yes.
Hey, they still scream.
Yeah, but how
do scream.
Yeah, I told you.
I'm always worried about people who don't go to work. Too much like me.
Well, some of you, we've known since you were, you know, we're considerably older than some of you out there, and known them since they were like 13 and 14. It's kind of weird. And then we've seen you grow up, have children, get married and everything else. You're still there, which is great. Thank you very much.
Gary, you're looking around here, you recognise some old faces, do you?
Yeah, no, there are some old faces out there. Some people are very loyal people. Stuck by us through certainly a lot of thin during those years when we fought and tore each other's hair out, and then we're still there when we got back together.
Yeah. Okay, let's have our first question from the studio audience. This one comes from Donna Crick, who's a drama teacher from Wakefield. She says she still has all of her original Spandau records on
Donna,
vinyl.
We've not met you before, have we? How are you? You're right.
Yeah, you?
Yeah, you're good. Yeah, I'm good, thanks. Not bad.
Right, shush.
Go on, it's your turn on stage. Go on.
Right, OK. Each Spandau album has had a different style and feel, changing direction each time. How have your musical influences inspired you, and have they changed over the years? So who influences you now?
Gary.
Let me just go back to the original part of the question about the band's changing its sound. And I think as a songwriter, you start to adapt your songs for the kind of venues you're going to play. So at the beginning, we were a club band, and we were writing songs like To Cut Long Story Short and Chart Number One. Very clubby sounds, very dry records. And then it was the theatres with True. We play, you know, the Festival Hall, the Albert Hall, you know, that kind of proscenium arch places. When I'm writing Parade, I'm still writing with that in mind. By the time Parade was so successful, we were playing arenas, then I'm writing for arenas. So through the Barricades album, which is much bigger and more anthemic and more guitar rock orientated, was written because we knew we'd have to play in front of, you know, how many thousand people in a big venue. That stuff sounds better.
But doesn't necessarily sound better on record when you're listening to it in a bedroom, does it? And that's what you lose. If you're writing and imagining the guy or the girl sitting in the back row of the Enorma Dome, you lose something of the intimacy, don't you?
Yeah, and I think that's true. I think I tried as a writer to do both in Through the Barricades. So that's the best of both worlds. It starts with a dry guitar and it's very, very intimate and ends up singing to the galleries.
Right. And this is a song which actually was inspired, from what I've read, by events in Northern Ireland. It's about kind of sectarian divide, love across the barricades.
I was in Belfast and a friend of ours in the band who'd worked on Merchandise had been killed in Belfast. And his brother, who was the drummer in Stiff Little Fingers, took me down Falls Road to see his grave, and I saw the barricades between all the streets dividing the two sides of Belfast. And then for a while we were living and writing in Dublin, and this was a song that I wrote completely lyric first. And it was really late at night. I was living with John Keeble, and then by the time the morning came, I'd actually added the music to it. And the first thing that probably came along was, I know what they're saying, It's a terrible beauty we've made, which is a Yeats line, obviously.
Right.
And we made our love on wasteland and through the barricades. So it has a folk lilt to it. And so I played it to John, who caught it out by a bleary eyed. What do you reckon?
Well, John Keeble, bleary eyed. He's a drummer.
But, you know, it was enough to restrain him back for 2 or 3 minutes at the beginning, and then he does it.
And is that important to you? You get a riff, you get the first idea, you have to play it to somebody, the drummer happens to be there in the bed next to you, you wake him up, you say, does it work?
I have to be absolutely honest. The worst feeling in the world, I mean, gut-wrenching, is to perform your new song to the band.
Right. Yeah.
You are terrified.
I should also just point out, I didn't mean you woke up in bed with John Keeble.
No. I was going to say, I wasn't going to go there, John.
No.
I didn't know you'd written the lyrics. So did you write the first melodic part? Well, you know, the, oh, turn around, I'll be there. Did that come?
It was really one, I suppose. You know, really? No, to be honest, I wrote the first 3-4 verses first.
On,
and then wrote the
on
music
paper, Gary, without any music in mind?
Yes, absolutely. And then the second half of the song... That came through the guitar lead.
Round and I'll be there. Oh, there's a scar right through my heart, but I'll bear it again. I thought we were the human race, but we were just another borderline case. And the stars reach down, they tell us that there's always one escape. They're saying it's a terrible beauty that we've made. So we make our love all wasteland through the barricades. And now I know what they're saying. Their hearts go to their Thank you. One of you's going to spot a lyric mistake in there, but hey.
Well, be that. I've been sitting here listening to your voice and marvelling at its depth and the fact that it still sounds exactly as it did back in the day. Is that because you've carried on singing?
Yeah, no, definitely. I mean, if you look at Tom Jones, who still sings all the time, Jack Jones, the swing singer, I saw him at Buxton Opera House the other week. And he's 75, and he still sings so brilliantly, and that's because he does it all the time. It's like anything. It's like
you don't
running.
Have to put up with Tony's exercises before we go on. which he has done religiously since the very early 80s, and it's held him in good stead.
Yeah.
Do you know what I have to say, though? That's always why, because I write for Tony, so some of the stuff was very rangy, you know, and was out of my... level of singing.
Some of it was out of mind, yeah, probably as well.
And so when I get up and I do the songs, you know, as the songwriter would have done it, I'm always like, I've got to sing that note. I've dropped a few keys, I must admit. And so it is kind of difficult.
You that know, must be difficult because you have different voices at different pitches, and so you're having to write with his voice in mind. You sit there with a guitar and you have to imagine how he will sing it before you even give it to him, which makes it difficult for you to sing.
You know, I'd written songs during the period when Spanner weren't working. And then when we put this acoustic album together for the comeback tour, 2009, and they said, could you do a new song? And instead of going home and seeing what bits I had, the inspiration of knowing I was now going to write a song for Tony, I just went straight back and wrote the music for Once More straight away. That was enough inspiration to write what I think turned out to be a really good song.
Can you do it now?
I can't do it. I don't know that.
Drums.
No, sorry, John.
Really? You really can't do it?
No, I've forgotten those chords.
I better start remembering. If we're going to go on tour again, we've really got to start learning this. You know?
This is interesting, though, Tony, because you are singing his lyrics, but are they hardwired in? Is it instant recall? Kind of.
Once a start, I mean, I think John Keeble said to me when we were rehearsing, he said, Gary said to John, he said, Tony's got these lyrics everywhere. He's got lyrics everywhere and he doesn't seem to know anything. And John said, hey, it'd be all right on the night. And I usually am.
Yeah, but the trouble is his wife had downloaded the lyrics off a Japanese translated website. And there were a few mistakes.
Yeah, I always seem to get it right. And if I don't get it right, I just make it up. And you know that,
you
don't
know, you? I mean, listen, yeah. I'm not a frontman. I'm very proud to stand on the left-hand side of the stage and just worry about my guitar and posing and making this big sound with the band. And this man just carries the front of house the whole night and does it brilliantly.
Oh, cheers, mate. Well, it's not a bad job, is it, really? When you think about it, we're very lucky to do what we've been doing for many years. We've been doing it. And I always just think we're just so lucky to be able to do what we love. Great.
Another question. This one comes from Dawn Beeching, who's a restaurant manager from Ashford in Kent. Dawn, where are you?
Hello, Dawn.
Hi. The True album set a benchmark for you. Did you find it a challenge to follow on from that success?
Yeah, it was. But I think we'd found a sound and we wanted to stay there, really. You know, we liked this voice that we had. Our popularity, I think, was quite confused in America. We were on Soul Train. I think we're the third white act to do Soul Train. I think Elton John and David Bowie had done it before us with True. And actually, we didn't do it with True. We did it with some songs that were on the Parade album.
Sorry, I can't remember. I've been really honest with you.
And what about Live Aid? Because, I mean, this is only a couple of years after the True album comes out, and you are at the height of your success, and you're touring the world. So, I mean, what are your memories of playing on that day in 1985?
I do remember that day. That's one day I do remember.
Of course he's seen it on video.
Do you know, I've never, ever watched it back. I've never. It was amazing. And when Quo opened the show, you could feel the hairs on the back of your neck go up, and you knew this was like mega, mega, mega. The sun was shining, there was 80,000 people there, and you were making a difference. You know, amazing.
No one had done anything like that before. I mean, you know, the Do They Know It's Christmas was the first sort of proper charity record, really. And people do charity records now and they have earnest face, you know, sincere. And we flew in with Duran Duran from a night completely on the tiles, painting somewhere in Germany red with them. And we arrived and got in the cars that the record company sent, which were Daimler Princesses, of course, in those days. And I remember getting out of this car and Sting walking up the road in an old Mac, and I just thought, we've blown it. Yeah, but of course, he parked his Daimler around the corner.
But it wasn't a good look to be turning up recording.
No, and I remember my brother going outside the door of the studio and he just held up his thumbs. He said, yeah, we're back. Sorry we can't be there, Ethiopia, this year, but next year. I mean, the thing is, can I just make a serious point? That if it wasn't for MTV and for the commerciality and the power of British bands around the world at that time, Live Aid wouldn't have been able to happen, you know. If you did Live Aid now, it would be a lot harder. There wouldn't be that many bands to pick from that would be known internationally. And there was then, and I think Geldof recognised that power of British groups. And I think, you know, all in all, forget the 60s, forget punk in the 70s. I think the most people power ever given was that day when people could vote with their postal orders or whatever it might be to change something or to do something that they felt strongly about that the government wasn't interested in. Mm. And that mentality stayed with us till today with Red Nose and all the things that happened.
Let's move on again. Next question is from Sharon Donaldson.
Hello, Sharon. How are you?
Do you know all of these people in this room?
Well, you just said her name.
Do you think?
Oh, I do know her anyway. Sorry, anyway, I diverse, sorry.
Hello.
Hello.
Gary's written a vast repertoire of songs. Is there a particular song that another artist has written that you wish you had written?
Well, there's a few, isn't there? There's always a
love. Save a Prayer, Planet Earth.
You're seriously winding him up, Tony. I know you love Duran Duran, but Gary clearly doesn't.
God, it's a good job John Keeble's not here, because he began...
If it's David Bowie, then it's Lady Grinning Soul. But I think Every Breath You Take is one of the great, great songs, because it goes back to those chords that I wrote my first song with, that I played in part one of this show. Instead of doing Jesus Rode Through Jericho on his way to the cross, he wrote Every Breath You Take, and that did quite well. It's all about structure. Yesterday, what a great song that is, you know. That uses a very different structure. It's AAB, it's called, and, you know, it starts with what is really the kind of the chorus integrated with the verse. You know, simple but beautifully clever.
Yeah, and we talked in the first part of the programme about growing up in Islington, all went to school together, but, Gary, you were acting as a kid. This is with the Anna Scher Youth Theatre. I mean, was it an option at an early age? Did you think, maybe I'm going to become an actor rather than a musician? Or were you always destined for pop music, do you think?
Yeah, my first band was with Phil Daniels, who went to Anna Shore as well. It was a drama club. I was very fortunate to live just across the road from Anna. I went without even telling my parents and ended up getting parts in films and TV at a young age. And I remember telling her at 16, when I met these guys in Potter's Bar, because our school had moved from Islington to Potter's Bar for a sixth form period, and punk had just happened. Went in, we found the band, and I went into Anna and I said, I'm leaving. You know, music was what I wanted to do. As an actor, you're not in control of what you do creatively. Mm. You're speaking other people's words, you're being told how to behave to a certain extent, and you're left to the vagaries of the cutting room and probably on the floor. And so with music, we're in control of it. And that was what's so brilliant coming out of our period. Our period was one of the first periods where we could go in and say to the record companies, we want to make a 12-inch dance mix. No one had done that. True is going to be our third single. Really? Yeah. We were calling the shots.
It's a different, very, very different time. I mean, record company-wise, today it's so much of a corporate affair, where in those days it was a much more creative, and people within record companies really, really cared. I honestly think if Spanner Ballet were around today, we would not have made the True album. We would have been dropped probably on our second album.
That's right.
Another question, next question, comes from Tracy Robinson.
What do you think of shows such as The X Factor and The Voice? Are they a good showcase for new talent, or do you feel they're not the best way to get started in the business?
Well, this is a question I get asked an awful lot. I'm sure Gary does as well. I personally don't have a problem with it. It's another talent show. You know, when I was a kid, we had New Faces, Opportunity Knocks. They're more powerful and they're more glamorous. But I also think that if you're a singer and you've got an opportunity to go on primetime Saturday night television and possibly win a record deal and possibly go on to make records and everything else, you're not going to turn it down. And I saw One Direction and they were great.
Gary, you look sceptical.
No, I'm not sceptical. Actually, I used to get rather angry about it and upset about it a while ago. But I think that music isn't as important to your average teenager now as it was to us. Because when we were younger, growing up in the 70s, that's all you had to express yourself with. And your only meeting place, your only gathering point, was at a rock concert where like-minded people would get together. And now, you don't need that. You can do that all on Facebook or whatever it might be, whatever social networking thing you use. You have a sense of power that way, and you have a sense of creativity as well. You know, to be creative in any way, you had to either wear certain clothes or pick up a guitar. Now you don't need to do that.
But I guess the argument against The X Factor and The Voice and those kind of shows is that that creativity at an early age, at an early stage in your career, is taken away from you, and then you're told what to do. Yeah. You had years putting together your ideas, and it became a crucial...
bands, though, John. I mean, you know, if you look at the Bay City Rollers, if you look at the Mickey Most acts and stuff, a lot of them were put together and there were Chin and Chapman writing teams. So it's always existed. And my thing about it is, it's always been there, but there's still great bands that are coming through that have come up the traditional way, like Spandau.
So. And Gary, you echo that. Are there enough young bands coming through doing it on their own terms?
Well, you know, how much do I know? I don't know that much. I think there are, and I do sort of occasionally, you know, have things that I go and listen to, and that's really good and that's very cool. And I don't think it's ever going to be quite the same scene as I was describing in part one, where a band represents a youth cult.
Yeah.
You know, that has finished. I mean, we'd kind of done postmodernism. And the next step was really just to look back. And Britpop was about looking back to the 60s. Now youth cults find their place on the internet through other, you know, it might be Instagram or it might be taking photography. That's great, but it's not like it used to be.
Sue Ashton has our next question. She says she's a married mum of three, also an accountant. She lives in Silverstone and has been a Spandau Ballet fan forever.
Do you regret any of your fashion choices from the early days?
Do you know, at the time, you think you look the nuts. You think you look absolutely fantastic.
Yeah, I was disappointed you haven't come in togas and kilts, though. I mean,
hey,
you know,
listen,
jodhpurs at least.
I want to wear spandex trousers, you know.
I remember we were in Portugal once and we flew from Lisbon down to Porto. This is 1981. And we're sort of travelling in flip-flops and shorts or whatever, you know. It's very hot, T-shirt. But we can't go on stage like that, obviously. But our gear doesn't arrive, none of it. So we're all sitting in the hotel room, panicking, when my brother suddenly has this great idea and he gets the white sheet off the bed and he starts ripping it up and puts some around his head, toga, and dress up. And we all go on stage that night wearing bed sheets.
Ridiculous.
And
blame Martin and then for the toga look then.
Yeah, and we came back. I remember going back to Lisbon to do a TV a few months later and people were wearing togas and bed sheets in the audience.
I do remember that.
I mean, listen, you know, go to see the Bow show at the V&A, you know, we're nowhere near as outrageous as some of that stuff. And we weren't inventing it just for on stage in those early days. We were actually wearing what kids were wearing in the clubs we were going to. That's what we were doing. And they were making it and designing it. And, you know, against this backdrop of recession and bin liners out on the street and three-day weeks, you'd have the most gloriously glamorous, outrageous kids with no money in their pocket, by the way, stalking the streets. And we were part of that. And I think that was really exciting. And I'm really proud of everything we did on that level.
But if you were going to those clubs, you know, in the kilts and the togas or dressed in jodhpurs or whatever, that's fine when you're walking around from club to club in Soho. But what about getting home or even going out in the evening?
Oh, no.
I mean, did you put the clothes in a bag and then get changed?
No, that was what we wore. I mean, I've got to tell you, I was going down to meet my mum and dad. They were down on the south coast somewhere. So I met my granddad, Bill T, at, I think it was Waterloo Station. And he was always a very smart man, a three-piece suit and everything. And I come along looking like, I don't know what I look like, with ballet slippers and things like that, makeup and stuff, and he refused to sit in the carriage with me. And then when he got down, he said to my mum, what the hell's going on? Look at the state of him.
Time for one more question this afternoon. This one comes from Meredith Float, who is originally from Brooklyn. Meredith.
How important was the success of True in America, and was the song's popularity a blessing or a curse?
The problem, I think, with America is that you didn't have the prehistory, if you like. You didn't have Cut Long Story Short chart number one, except on a kind of club, culty level.
On the coast.
Yeah, on the coast. So in mainstream America, the first thing they saw were five really smart-looking young guys who every mother loved, and that was their first image of us and their first, you know,
they didn't get
sound.
The irony.
They didn't get the gritty bit before. So in a way, it was a blessing and it was a curse. Yeah
I mean, it's certainly a blessing as far as... We're very proud. That song's had, you know, over 4 million plays in America alone on the radio. And it's been covered by lots of artists, and really great black artists have covered it, you know.
It's been sampled by so many hip-hop acts,
you know,
isn't it?
Will I Am's had a go, and Nelly's had a go, and...
PM Dawn, most famously, with...
Lloyd.
Yeah, I was in the video.
R. Kelly.
I was there.
Were you?
I remember that.
Yeah, diving in a swimming pool.
I was meant to be a ghostly figure coming out of the...
Somehow I find that really difficult to imagine.
It was a holiday in Miami, and it was like, hey, it was really nice.
But, I remember when I did The Bodyguard, Kevin Costner said to me, you know, that song belongs to me and my wife. And I thought, wow, that, I thought it belonged to my plumbers and his wife. Because that's what he told me. Anyway, it didn't keep them together, did it?
You very casually slipped in there about doing The Bodyguard with Kevin Costner, because we've forgotten that, I mean, after doing The Craze with your brother, then you had a time in Hollywood and you tried to make it as an actor. Was the band a calling card? Did people in Hollywood know you as a songwriter? Or did you have to start totally from scratch? Were you just some Brit trying his luck?
No, they did know about Spandau, obviously. But, you know, I think all of us by the end of the 90s were slightly exhausted by the treadmill of being in the band of, you know, album, get on the road, that was great, and then trying to write another album. And the end of the 80s was difficult. A new generation was coming through that didn't want us and Duran. It was the rave culture was happening. Mm. And I think it was time for us to step aside. We didn't mean to step aside for 19 years, though. I'm really sorry about it. When I sort of went on and tried to do other things as an actor and solo musician, whatever it might be, in the 90s, I'd get really infuriated when I'd read in a newspaper, Spandau Ballet's Gary Kemp. I was like, I couldn't separate myself. And I was trying to outrun this shadow that was just much too long for me. And it wasn't until about 2005, remixing a DVD of us playing at the NEC, when I looked up and I thought, you know what? What a great band to be in. I am glad I'm Spandau Ballet's Gary Kemp. And that's when we started making phone calls and trying to make it happen again.
Well, that's all we've time for in this edition of Master Tapes. Thanks to our audience here at the BBC Maida Vale Studios. Thanks for all of your questions. And most of all, thanks to Spandau Ballet's Gary Kemp and Tony Hadley.
Thank you very much. Thank you.
That was great fun. Don't forget the Master Tapes pages at the Radio 4 website. You can download today's programme as well as the rest of the series. There's exclusive content there, including full versions of songs played live here at Maida Vale and some videos of our Master Tapes guests. And you can tweet us using the hashtag MasterTape. But we leave you now with Gary Kemp and Tony Hadley playing us out with... What are you going out with?
Oh, it's got to be A Bit of Gold.
It's got to be.
Thank you for coming home. Sorry that the chairs are all worn. I left them here, I could have sworn. These are my salad days, slowly being eaten away. Just another plea for today. Oh, but I'm proud of you, proud of you. Nothing left to make me feel small. Luck has left me standing so tall. Gold, I always believe in you.
And if you want to hear more material recorded at this Master Tape session, including exclusive performances, photographs, and videos, go to the Master Tapes pages via the Radio 4 website.
Gold, glad that you failed to return. Something I could have learned. You're indestructible.